Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll be joined by Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, who was the United States Ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002. She was previously Deputy High Commissioner for the UN High Commission on Refugees from 2004 to 2006. And she was Deputy Chief of Mission in the U.S. Embassy in Kuala Lumpur, Director of Press and Public Affairs at the Near East Bureau, and Director of Global Affairs and Counterterrorism at the National Security Council from 1991 to 1993. And then we'll look and analyze the political landscape of healthcare as the two Senate bills and the eight House bills collide this week. We'll be joined by Emily Friedman, who's an award-winning independent writer, speaker, teacher, and health policy and ethics analyst. She writes for the Journal of the American Medical Association and Health Progress, among other periodicals, and she's also a professor of bioethics in the Department of Health, Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at the Boston University School of Public Health. And readers of Modern Healthcare named her as one of the 100 most powerful people in the healthcare field. And in April of 2005, the editors of that same publication named her as one of the top 25 women in healthcare. And then we'll assess the president's speech last night on expanding gay rights and his pledge to end the military's don't ask, don't tell policy, with Tobias Wolf, who writes and teaches civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he's also currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. He served as counsel on Strauss versus Horton, challenging a ballot initiative seeking to deprive same-sex couples of the right to marry, and Cook v. Gates, challenging the constitutionality of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He was also legal advisor to and policy chair to Senator Barack Obama in Obama for America's 2008 campaign. And then in the second hour on Live from the Left Coast, we'll be joined by Senator Max Cleland, a triple amputee from the Vietnam War, became United States Senator. He has a new book we'll be talking about, The Heart of a Patriot, How I Found the Courage to Survive Vietnam, Walter Reed and Karl Rove. And then we'll discuss how China and the United States economy may merge rather than compete in the future. We'll be joined by Zachary Carabel. He's got a new book, which we're going to be also discussing. The book is called Superfusion, How China and America Became One Economy and Why the World's Prosperity Depends on It. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, who was the United States Ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002. She was previously Deputy High Commissioner for the UN High Commission on Refugees from 2004 to 2006, and she was Deputy Chief of Mission in the U.S. Embassy in Kuala Lumpur, Director of Press and Public Affairs at the Near East Bureau, and Director of Global Affairs and Counterterrorism at the National Security Council from 1991 to 1993. And clearly, Ambassador Chamberlain, as the Pakistan military was poised to attack the Taliban in Waziristan, suddenly the Taliban turn around and attack them right in the very heart of the military's power, their headquarters in the nation's capital. The Pakistani commanders, of course, have rescued the 25 hostages, and the incident is over. But this does clearly indicate that the Pakistani military has a war on their hands and perhaps don't have the initiative.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it does indicate that the threat of the insurgency on the Pakistan military in the state of Pakistan is serious. The country, of course, woke up to that very fact during this last spring with the insurgency in the Malakand district in the Swat Valley, where both the politicians and the military agreed that they had to take be more proactively aggressive against the Taliban. And the message in this attack is that it's going to be a long, hard fight.
Well, just in the context, though, of U.S. relations with both Pakistan's civilian government and the previous military government. At the moment, there's quite a debate going on in Pakistan, I understand, about U.S. intentions to expand its embassy. Apparently, the military are not, Pakistan's military are not happy with the aid package, which has been, in fact, more geared towards the civilian government than the military government over the years. Musharraf was getting, I think, what about $1 billion a year? $10 billion, I think, he got altogether. There's a peculiar sort of sense of entitlement, it seems, on the part of the Pakistani military that can basically say, you know, we want the money, not the civilian government. So what's your reaction to this?
Well, that's one interpretation. I'm not sure that the military is saying we want the aid, because they are getting a fairly sizable package of military assistance from us in addition to the proposed $1.5 billion that is for the civilians, for the people of Pakistan.
But they are saying, aren't they? Ambassador Chamberlain, they are saying that we're interfering in their domestic affairs.
And that's what they're saying. They're not saying we want the money. They're saying we don't want to have any assistance to Pakistan conditioned. We don't want you telling us what to do. Stay out of our business. I think that's misguided. I think this is a question of diplomacy, and certainly there can be a way found to satisfy everybody's needs. But I think it's enormously important that the American people send a message to Pakistan that our relationship is not just with the military, it's also with the people of Pakistan. And that's what the Kerry Lugar Berman bill was meant to do.
Well, there's been some debate for some time, and I think the conclusions have been around for some time that the success of the insurgents and the sudden emergence of a Pakistan Taliban is all to do with the lack of delivery on the civilian front. And I'm just curious as to why, having been threatened so recently with an incursion that got close to the nation's capital, there isn't a general recognition on the part of the elite in Pakistan that until you compete, if you will, on the hearts and minds front, you're not going to win.
Well, to tell you the truth, Ian, I totally agree with you. I think that the most effective counterinsurgency strategy is going to be one where the government of Pakistan pulls together and begins to get three steps out in front of the Taliban that is very, very clever in manipulating the grievances of the people. And the grievances of the people are just as you say. The people are they want jobs, they want livelihoods, they want the inflation to be tamped down, they want access to land. Pakistan is very much still a feudal state run by a very few landowning families, and the people of Pakistan feel as if they've been neglected. Taliban are good at cleaving along these fault lines, and both the army and the political elites of Pakistan would be wise to pull together and start meeting the needs of the people so they could undercut the appeal of the Taliban.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, who served as United States Ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002. And we're talking about the Pakistan military having retaken the headquarters, rescued the hostages. But certainly a signal has been sent from the insurgents that they can strike at will at the very heart of Pakistan's military power. And this is, of course, on the eve of a planned offensive in Waziristan against the Taliban. Now, if we can just look ahead a bit as how the chips may fall here in terms of, I would have thought the largely Punjabi military in Pakistan are proud, and they would this would be a grievous insult to them. So if this is meant on the part of the Taliban to deter a forthcoming attack, isn't the opposite more likely, that they'll be that the Pakistani military may go after them with a vengeance?
Well, I think you're right, and I would certainly hope that's the case. This has not been the first bold strike by the Taliban right in the heart of Rawalpindi. You recall that Benazir Bhutto was assassinated what we believe to be by the same groups that have carried out the attack today, Pakistani Taliban, struck and killed an aspiring prime minister right in the heart of the military city. So they've done it before. They've shown now that they can do it again. And as I say, I think it's going to be a very difficult struggle to keep Pakistan, to restore safety and stability in Pakistan.
And since we do have what's called an AFPAC strategy, that our war, if you will, in Afghanistan is closely tied to the situation in Pakistan. And just today, Senator Levin, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said that what we need in Afghanistan is a new strategy, not more boots on the ground. And we know, that the president's in the middle of reviewing the next step. And apparently Vice President Biden has been counseling him on sort of not so much taking the fight to Pakistan, but at least recognizing that that's where the main problem exists. How do you reconcile, or how does one reconcile, Ambassador Chamberlain, this notion that the Pakistani military on the one hand are fighting the Taliban, their homegrown Taliban, if you will, and yet the nominal head of the Taliban in Afghanistan is in the Pakistani city of Quetta, conducting a war. I mean, it's hard not to believe that the orders to attack the Indian embassy in Kabul, the orders to attack the Germans and try and break up the ISAF coalition. You get the impression that the Mullah Omar is alive and well and very active.
Mullah Omar has long believed to have be established in Quetta. Although there are some doubts about that now, he may in fact be holed up in some small village in Afghanistan. The truth is, we don't really know. I think you're making a very good point, but I think it would be wrong to assume that the Taliban in Afghanistan is a monolith, or that the Taliban and the insurgency and the extremists in Pakistan are one group. They're many groups. It's a loose federation. Mullah Omar doesn't call the shots for what's happening. Happened in Rawalpindi today. I think that was probably the group of Pakistani Taliban, now headed by Haki Mullah Masood, the younger brother of Betula Masood, who was killed
by a predator,
by an American
yeah.
drone recently. Yes. Right. So these are different groups. Unfortunately, I think they have the same ideology, which is to attack the far enemy in the West, the United States, and the near enemy, meaning the government, whether it's in Kabul or Islamabad.
And when you were ambassador to Pakistan, Ambassador Chamberlain, I imagine that you came across anti-Americanism. And I remember interviewing Dr. Pervez Hoodbhoy, who said that one of the problems in Pakistan is that it's difficult for Pakistan to recognize how much it is threatened from within, because many Pakistanis are blinded by anti-Americanism. And it seems that what's been going on in the press about the intentions of this new embassy have been inflaming the people. Who is behind this kind of drumbeat of anti-Americanism, or is it genuinely felt?
Well, there is anti-Americanism. It's also just a sense of distrust, and this distrust deficit, which actually has a name, goes back for several decades. And you know, if you talk to Pakistani, he can get very animated to tell you how the United States started the trust deficit. And if you talk to any American historian, they can make an equally enthusiastic case that it's been misunderstandings on the Pakistani side. Basically, you have to understand in Pakistan, there's a part of the political mystique is one of conspiracy theories. For example, even very intelligent, educated people, but the majority of people actually believe in Pakistan that there's an American, Indian, Israeli plot to seize their weapons and break up the country. This, of course, is not true, but people believe it, and it's kind of the fire behind the anti-Americanism that you talk about?
Well, what is likely then to galvanize the Pakistanis around recognizing that perhaps they do have some common interest in getting rid of the Taliban, or at least trying to stabilize Afghanistan and indeed stabilize their own country. I mean, I understand that the Pakistani military and the intelligence service, the ISI, are very distrustful of the government in Kabul, if indeed you can call it a government, given the recent fraud in the elections and the unpopularity of Karzai. But there's a sense that India has gotten involved in there, and that the Pakistanis feel that the U.S. is not recognizing that need for strategic stability in their eyes on their western flank. And we, on the other hand, have been asking them for cooperation forever about getting al-Qaeda. And one of the things that's so puzzling about this war in Afghanistan is that we appear to be at war with millions of people in one country in order to eliminate a few hundred people in another.
Well, it is a very complex situation. You're absolutely right. The Pakistanis do feel squeezed from a very thin country, a highly populated country of 170 million people, but it's really quite thin. And they do feel as if they're squeezed with an adversary, India, on the east, and very strong Afghan-Indian relations on the west. And this makes, of course, the army feel very vulnerable. And part of its strategy in the future is to make sure that it maintains good relations with the Taliban, hedging its bet for the day when the United States will pull out and the Taliban will resume, will reestablish a regime in Kabul. Now, we hope that won't happen. We're dedicated to see that it doesn't happen, but there's a certain element in the Pakistan military that's hedging its bets in that regard out of a sense of survival. And that explains almost a duality in its policy. It is fighting Taliban extremists in its own country, but it seems to be aiding or maintaining relations with the Taliban in Afghanistan also for its own security. To get to your question, how do we get to a sense of cooperation, a sense that we're actually fighting the same enemy, which is the threat to Pakistan and the threat to Pakistan and to Afghanistan? I think we need to have very open and clear public discussions on what our intentions are. Our intentions, for example, we should give a speech, be very clear. Our intentions is not to build a military base in Pakistan and pretend it's an embassy. Our intention is simply to expand our embassy with civilians so that we can help disperse this huge aid package that's coming. We need a better a public dialogue in Pakistan to help undercut some of these conspiracy theories that are out there.
Well, Ambassador Chamberlain, thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles at such short notice. I appreciate your joining us and what you had to tell us.
Ian, it's a tissue, but we've just got to keep working on it.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, who was U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002. She was also previously the Deputy High Commissioner for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And I'm now speaking with Emily Friedman, who's an award-winning independent writer, speaker, teacher, and health policy and ethics analyst based in Chicago. She's authored more than 750 articles on healthcare issues for various publications, including the Journal of the American Medical Association, Health Progress, and other periodicals. Emily Friedman serves as an adjunct professor of Bioethics in the Department of Health Law, Bioethics and Human Rights at the Boston University School of Public Health. And readers of Modern Healthcare have named her as one of the 100 most powerful people in the healthcare field. And in April of 2005, the editors of that same publication named her as one of the top 25 women in healthcare. And it seems now that we've got, eight bills in the House and the Baucus bill in the Senate. We're getting down to the wire, but today the New York Times is reporting that two of the last elements that haven't been compromised, that is scaling back the Cadillac tax on high-cost healthcare plans and a nonpartisan Medicare budget-cutting commission, are under furious assault. One key congressman says the lobbyists are winning. Emily, at the end of the day, will the lobbyists win or will the people win?
I would have to give the edge to the lobbyist at this point. And if I might just make a minor technical correction, there are two bills in the Senate. The committee led by the late Senator Kennedy, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions bill, was voted out of committee some time ago, and the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is currently trying to lead discussions between members of that committee, which is currently led by Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, and the Senate Finance Committee, which is, of course, led by Senator Max Baucus. The vote by the Senate Finance Committee is supposed to be on Tuesday. So there are some very furious discussions and negotiations going on within Senate Finance to get that bill voted out. That bill is more conservative than the other committee's bill, so they still have some work to do in the Senate. And then the House bills, of which the major contenders are three, which are very similar, are much more liberal than the Senate bills. So we've got many rivers to cross yet. In terms of the two issues that you mentioned, the taxation on lavish health benefits, I think what is described as lavish depends, you know, where you stand, as you know, depends on where you sit. They were talking about a floor of $8,000 a year. That's not a lavish health benefit in most cases. You know, $20,000 might be more like it. And in terms of some kind of public option, I thought it was off the table. Senator Baucus made it very clear that he wasn't going to support it. The amendments offering the public option to the Senate Finance Bill were all voted down. So the fight may be on the Senate floor. Overall, in terms of lobbyists, the most important and powerful lobby are the private insurers. So far, they've pretty much gotten everything they wanted. They have probably killed the public option. Any regulation of them is very weak. There's very little cost containment. They're a very, very effective lobby. As long as you're an insurer, this is an admirable effort on their part. However, I don't think it helps the uninsured poor. And I thought that, stupid me, I thought the uninsured were supposed to be the point of this exercise.
Well, clearly, Senator Kennedy is missed in this. And the idea that Senator Baucus is as far to the left as you begin in a discussion. Normally, in a negotiation, you ask for more than you're going to receive. It seems that the Democrats are going into this asking for less.
I think that the politics of it are accidental. One cannot overstate the impact of the loss of Senator Kennedy. He could work with Republicans. The last two major pieces of health legislation that we got, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act and the State Children's Health Insurance Program, were directly attributable to his ability to work with Republicans, in one case with former Senator Nancy Kassenbaum, the other with current Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. But the senator is dead. There's nothing to be done about that. Senator Baucus, as Democrats go, is moderate to conservative. The more liberal members of the Senate Finance Committee, which, as you stated, is got the leading bill, has the leading bill at the moment, Senator Wyden, Senator Rockefeller are not happy with this bill. But I frankly think they're going to hold their noses and vote for it. I think it will get to the Senate floor, and the fight will take place there.
And one of the things that's least discussed in all of this is, even though the single payer was not really on the table and a compromise known as the public option was on the table, and you've just mentioned it probably won't survive, with all of the progressives and the Democrats and the Progressive Caucus pinning their hopes on the public option, there's been very little analysis of exactly what it is. If it were to pass, would it work in terms of being a lever to keep the insurance companies honest?
Well, there are two reasons for having a public option, and if you'll allow me, Ian, very simply for your many listeners, a public option would have been, I guess it still has a chance, so I will say will be, a publicly funded insurance plan along the lines of Medicare. The government sells the insurance, pays the bills, et cetera. And the idea behind it was that this would provide competition for the private insurers. I have to tell you the truth. I think that's a stupid reason for having it. If you want to regulate the private insurers, then regulate the private insurers. I see no reason to come up with this clumsy public plan that would be toothless. And by the way, I should add, if such a plan were passed, the private insurers are not stupid, and it would be very easy to arrange that all the sick people ended up in the public plan and all the healthy people ended up in the private plans. The cost of the public plan would then become astronomical, and the whole thing would fail. The other reason for the public plan, which is what I call stealth single payer, is that if we had a public plan that was competing with the private plans, guess what? It would be cheaper. It would not discriminate on the basis of health status. It would not have stockholders that it was legally and ethically responsible to in terms of paying dividends. Its cost structure would be much lower. It would be cheaper. Of course it could undercut the private plans. That's why they didn't want it. And if you're going to set up a public plan that has the same prices as private plans, so that it would be a level playing field, what's the point?
Well, T.R. Reid, of course, has done a very helpful book where he went around the world comparing healthcare systems in the rest of the world, or at least in the developed world, and he points out that single payer is by no means the only alternative to what we have in this country, that other countries like Switzerland and Holland and Taiwan and other countries use a...
And France and Germany and Israel and a lot of other countries.
They use an insurance model.
Yeah.
But they regulate them. And apparently in Switzerland, if your claim is not paid promptly, the insurance company is mandated to give you the next month's premium free.
Yeah, as I said, if you're going to regulate the insurers, regulate them. Now, there is another political issue here, because historically, insurance regulation has been the domain of the states. And I was just at a conference of the National Academy for State Health Policy, which is state officials. Some of the states that do regulate their insurers rather tightly, New York, Vermont, Massachusetts, Maine, others, even California, which actually has quite a bit of legislation on this, these states are scared stiff that some federal mandate is going to come down and tell them that they have to loosen up on the insurers. My feeling is whatever insurance regulation gets passed, and I don't think there's going to be much of it, should be a floor. If states want to go beyond that, fine. But every state should at least engage in minimal regulation of insurers. And I think there are three things that could be done that would make a huge difference. One of them is we go back to what's called community rating, which is everybody in a given area, you know, Los Angeles County, Southern California, whatever, pays the same premium if they are in the same age group. And it's called community rating. It basically means if you've got cancer, you're not going to pay any more than somebody who's healthy. This is how health insurance used to be arranged, and I frankly think we should return to it. The second thing that I would propose, I'm sorry, this sounds really health policy wonky, and I'm very sorry, but it's not my language. It's the language of the situation. There's something called a medical loss ratio, which is I'm the Emily Friedman Health Insurance Company, and I make $100 million a month. And because of my obligation to stockholders, my incentive is to pay as little out in claims as possible. What I pay in claims is called the medical loss ratio. So let's say I pay 70% of my revenue out paying people's health insurance bills, you know, their health care bills. The other 30% I get to keep. That's what's called the medical loss ratio. Many state insurance commissioners have said, let's have a minimum medical loss ratio around 90%. That 90% of all the money that comes in has to go back paying your policyholders' claims. It would really help in terms of getting some of the predatory practices out of the field. And if there are some insurers that don't wish to accept that, fine. And the third thing I would say is if an insurer violated either of those two provisions, they don't get to sell insurance in my state anymore. It would take about two of those cases when, you know, Alaska says, I'm sorry, you know, you're gone. You can't sell insurance here anymore, before the insurers got the message. All of that, by the way, could be done very easily without, you know, massive restructuring of the healthcare system. But I have to tell you the truth, Ian, it's not going to happen, in my opinion.
Well, Emily Friedman, the more we talk, the more I wonder why they got off on the wrong foot here. I know Obama didn't want to repeat the mistakes of Bill Clinton. However, why not start with build on Medicare? I mean, just phase it in, Medicare for all.
If you talk to one of the most powerful California congressmen, two of them, in fact, one of whom represents a Northern California district, one of them a Southern California district, and that's Congressman Pete Stark and Congressman Henry Waxman. They've been asking the same question for some time. Pete Stark has put bill after bill after bill in saying Medicare for all. Medicare works. People are happy with it. As a matter of fact, Ian, during all of these protests against health reform that were held during these town hall meetings over the summer, my favorite sign, and actually somebody was holding a sign that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Hmm. Well, there's no limit to the public ignorance, I'm afraid.
And also who organized the rally and what interest groups were behind it. I know there's a whole lot of disinformation going on right now. But and also, by the way, in terms of, to answer your comment, in terms of regular citizens being ignorant, of course they're ignorant. This discussion has been largely conducted in the halls of Congress and in back rooms using language that a PhD in linguistics couldn't understand. Health policy has a nasty habit of always excluding the public, and it's happening again. Anyway, in terms of Medicare for all, basically you're going to have three very strong sets of opponents to that. One of them is the private insurers. For obvious reasons, public programs can displace private programs. The second is a lot of healthcare providers. Medicare pays less than a lot of private insurers do. And the hospitals, a lot of physicians, nursing homes and others, would be very concerned if millions of more people were getting care paid at Medicare rates, because those rates are not as high as others. They are higher than Medicaid rates, the program for the poor, but in generally speaking, they're less than what private payers pay. And the third is just ideological. There are a great many people in Congress and in the United States who don't want any more expansion of government's role in health care. regardless of the fact that half of them are on Medicare. But I think that you have a very strong opposition. There's a middle ground, which I support strongly, and that still has a bit of life in Congress, although I would put it in the improbable category. And that is to allow people over the age of 50 or over the age of 55 to buy into Medicare, paying insurance premiums just like anybody else does, at what the current per-person cost is of Medicare. I support this because this 50 to 64 age group pays enormous insurance premiums.
Well, they also, you have to pay a supplemental any rate if you have a Medicare.
Yeah, but I'm talking about younger people getting into Medicare. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the truth. I'm in the individual market. I'm self-employed. I pay $10,400 a year for the worst insurance you've ever seen, and that includes a very high deductible. I think that there are a lot of people in this age group who would gleefully sign up for Medicare, and that accomplishes three things. First, you bring a younger, healthier, cheaper group of people into the program, which reduces the per-person cost. The second thing is that people who are paying huge amounts of money and hanging on by their fingernails until they qualify for Medicare can get in and get good coverage, and they can pick a private option. They could sign up for private insurance. Medicare pays for private insurance if that's what you want. But the third thing is, in terms of actually providing true competition to the private insurers, let them compete for the pre-Medicare group. And that would be easy. There, Rockefeller wanted to do it. There are others on the Hill who wanted to do it. The private insurers are desperate to defeat it, and I don't know how that's going to come out.
Well, just in the last minute, Emily Friedman, you mentioned the states playing a role and playing they could play an even more powerful and constructive role. The Massachusetts system, how's that doing? Is there any model out there that can be emulated?
Every state is different. Hawaii tried, and really circumstances beyond Hawaii's control really softened their impact. They did that in the early 90s. But Hawaii has a model because Hawaii is the only state that can require employers to cover most of their workers. Massachusetts has done very well in terms of coverage, but they are suffering terrible cost problems. Eastern Massachusetts, the Boston area, is the most expensive healthcare market in the United States. They're now trying to work on cost because otherwise this program is going to break the state bank. Vermont has just launched its program, but so far so good. And Maine has also been pretty successful, but again, they ran into state budget problems. You know what the economy has been like. So Maine had to freeze its program after 30,000 people signed up. That doesn't sound like much to a Californian, but there are only 1 million people in Maine. Mm-hmm. Maine is now able to reopen its program. But every state is unique, and I must tell you that for Maine, Massachusetts, and Vermont, which always had high levels of coverage anyway, it's not so difficult, and I'm sorry, I have to say this because there's a demographic involved here. Maine, Massachusetts, and Vermont are really white states, very high proportions of white people. If you look at the state of California, which has a distressingly high rate of uninsured people, nearly 20%, and a highly diverse state, if you look at Texas, New Mexico, Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, those are the states with the worst problems, and they have very high percentages of people who are uninsured, and a lot of them are low-income minority workers. And I don't know how much political appetite there is in a state like Arizona or Texas for taxing people to cover people of other races. There's no kind way to say it. There are racial factors involved.
Well, we know that from the rebel yell from Joe Wilson.
Yes, well,
in front of Obama. Just to finish up though, and try and summarize, Emily Friedman, it seems to me that what's happened here is that there've been so many competing plans, there's been so much confusion, so much wonkishness, so much obfuscation, so many backroom deals, that the public and then you've got these noisy people out shutting down debate, the teabaggers. At the end of the day, the thing that you just mentioned, which is a buy-in of Medicare, is such a simple, workable plan. How is anybody going to get the American people focused on something that's going to work?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion, but please understand that all of this has been politicized. The private insurers right now are really winning, and they don't want anybody else to be able to buy into Medicare. But I'll tell you three reasons for hope, Ian. The first is they have to pass something. Too much political capital has been spent for them not to pass something. It may just be nibbling around the edges, but we might get some improvement, at least for people who are working in low-wage jobs and don't have coverage and whose kids die of measles, and that should be the point of all of this. The second reason for hope is we still have a lot of debate to come. We have a lot of effort that's going to take place in the Senate and the House to reconcile these bills into something that is less conservative than what Max Baucus came up with. And the third thing is California tried. Now, California didn't make it, but California tried to go on its own and do something about the uninsured, about cost, and about some of the basic problems with the health care system. The states are going to continue to proceed. I think so many states are so sick of doing nothing that they're going to keep working. Santa Clara County here in California covers every child. So does the state of Illinois. So does the state of Pennsylvania. New Jersey very quietly is moving toward universal coverage. The states are moving. And I think California will try again. I'm sorry about gridlock on the Hill, but we don't know what they're going to come up with. And I think there is hope that some improvements might be made.
Well,
and by the way, I need to say this. I am not an advocate of a single-payer system, but I believe in a Medicare buy-in. And the fact that I think a public-private mix is the most culturally comfortable thing for Americans does not mean that the private insurers should be allowed to run wild discriminating against people who are sick. I find that insane. I always have, and I always will.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Emily Friedman.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking there with Emily Friedman, who's an award-winning independent writer, speaker, teacher, and health policy and ethics analyst. She is a professor of bioethics in the Department of Law, Health Law, Bioethics and Human Rights at the Boston University School of Public Health, and readers of Modern Healthcare named her as one of the 100 most powerful people in the healthcare field. And in April of 2005, the editors of that same publication named her as one of the top 25 women in healthcare. And I'm now speaking with Tobias Barrington Wolf, who writes and teaches in civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's also currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, and he served as counsel on Strauss versus Horton, challenging a ballot initiative seeking to deprive same-sex couples of the right to marry, and Cook v. Gates, challenging the constitutionality of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He was also legal advisor and LGBT policy chair to Senator Barack Obama's campaign, Obama for America, in 2008. And I thank you so much for joining us. And obviously, following the president's speech last night before the Human Rights Campaign, where the president pledged to expand gay rights, and he also pledged to end the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. I guess the question now, Tobias Wolf, is it's not so much if, but when.
I think that's true, Ian, and thank you very much for having me on your program. It's a pleasure to speak with you again. The great importance of what the president did last night, and it's quite continuous with what he has been saying and doing both as a candidate and since his election, but it really was punctuated, I think, in his address last night, is he placed the moral authority of his presidency and he placed the moral authority of his administration behind the proposition of full equality for gay and lesbian and transgender and bisexual citizens and for same-sex couples. And that goes for domestic policy on issues like the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act, the enactment of workplace protections for LGBT employees, and the repeal of the military Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. It was an unprecedented act for a sitting president, and the fact that the president did it early in his first term, in the first year of his administration, and did it in such unequivocal and powerful terms is a very important moment indeed.
But do you think it's going to sort of quieten down the anger that is very manifest? I saw some interviews on cable news yesterday and last night where there's a lot of impatience and a lot of sense that we've heard this before. We want to see some action.
Well, I don't think it should quiet down the urgency. And the president himself both reiterated in his address last night that people should be impatient, and that indeed a part of the job of electing an administration and having people in positions of power who are prepared to work with you on your priorities is to keep up the pressure. And the president actually reiterated that last night. So I think the president knows as well as just about anybody in the American political scene today what it requires to get change done, especially in a resistant political climate. And for better or worse, and it says a lot about how far we have to go within our own Democratic Party, there is still resistance to some of the most basic reforms, and the president is fighting against that resistance and attempting to push this agenda through Congress.
And Tobias Wolff, what do you think Barney Frank was saying when he sort of dismissed the demonstration that's taking place today? This is before, of course, it took place.
Yeah, so, I must say, I have a great deal of respect for Representative Frank, and I like him a great deal. I don't agree with the way that he expressed that sentiment. In part, I think that Representative Frank, obviously I can't speak for him, but what I understood him to be saying was that he didn't think that the demonstrations in Washington this weekend would have a big impact upon his fellow members of Congress. And he may be right about that. He certainly knows more about that than almost anyone. But it's also the case that there are 12 million Americans who are second-class citizens in their own home. And that is an outrage. And I think it is both appropriate and necessary for people to make themselves heard on the continuing urgency of keeping issues of equality at the top of the agenda. So, you know, whatever its immediate political impact might be, I think it is good that people are making their voices heard. What I think is also important is that they make their voices heard in a way which is smart and productive. And one of the things that I have found a little bit unfortunate in reactions to the progress or the pace of progress over the last 9 months is that Congress has not been getting the pressure that it needs. The president can do a certain amount on his own as the executive and has done a fair amount already, has made a lot of progress in areas that are under executive control. A lot of what we want done requires actions by Congress. And while it's quite appropriate to keep the pressure up on the president to be in turn making those reforms a priority in his work with Congress, at the end of the day, Congress is the one who needs to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, enact the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and so forth. And so the anger and the impatience, I understand, and I certainly share the impatience. I think that we need to direct a bit more of it at Congress than has happened up until this point.
Well, there was some progress this week in the Congress, though, in the House on the hate crimes legislation. It was tied to an important defense appropriation, which created some howls of anger from in Republican quarters, including, of course, the famous Joe Wilson's the rebel yell in front of President Obama's address to the Congress. He and others were screaming about it and saying, "How dare you stick it on this bill?" Of course, which of course has been going on for the last 8 years. It's a bit of a case of the pot calling the kettle black. However, the subtext of the arguments from people like Republican Congressman Wilson from South Carolina, I think is, you know, without trying to, you know, characterize it unfairly, it's pretty clear that, and I believe that it's being, in some ways, the argument's being generated by James Dobson of Focus on the Family. What they're really saying is that if you pass this hate crimes legislation, it means that preachers won't be able to vilify homosexuals from the pulpit. What an extraordinary right to want to defend.
Indeed. Well, there's a few things to say about that. First of all, first and foremost, it is sheer nonsense. It is simply a falsehood that has been perpetrated about this bill in an attempt to kill it, because how do you argue against taking a law which already identifies hate crimes that are targeted at other communities and expanding that law to include one of the communities that is most frequently targeted for this kind of biased, motivated crime? How do you argue against that? Well, you make up a cock and bull story about preachers and their message from the pulpit is somehow going to be interfered with. That it's sheer nonsense. But, you know, it speaks to a broader issue. And the broader issue is, and this goes back to your observation a moment ago about Representative Wilson and others, I fear that the Republican Party and the political right in this country has really been reduced to screaming in the last year or so. That really seems to be all that they bring to the table. And I think that's bad for democracy. As much as I very much more agree with the party platform of the Democratic Party, I think that we are better off when we have a healthy two-party system in which there is real debate between the parties on substantive issues, and in which, for example, enlightened Republicans may see the wisdom of promoting a pro-equality agenda. And there are, in fact, Republican candidates in various places around the country who have recognized that LGBT equality is an important value that they should have as a part of their own party platform. They're in the minority in their own party, but they're out there. So I think that the message, the story behind people like James Dobson and Representative Wilson and others is that they are symptomatic of a real failing in our democracy right now, and that the country would be better off if we had a strong and rational Republican Party to be debating instead of all of this screaming.
Well, Tobias Wolff, the president did say in his speech that he thought that the hate crimes legislation would pass in the Senate and that he would sign it.
Quite right.
What about the defense of marriage, though? You mentioned a couple of other legislative hurdles.
Yeah, the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act is a very important step forward. The president has been strongly in favor of getting rid of that discriminatory statute since early in his career.
And that's a fairly recent one, essentially invented by Karl Rove.
The statute was enacted in 1996.
Oh, I see.
And it was enacted with a whole bunch of hysteria about whether marriages were going to be imposed upon unwilling states. The primary effect that it has to this day is to deny equal treatment to gay and lesbian couples under federal law. And it is going to take work to develop the support that we need in Congress to get rid of that statute, in part because it's going to require education. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what the statute does and about what repealing it would mean. And I don't know when we're going to have the support in Congress for that, but you don't get the support unless you keep doing what the president has been doing, which is keeping it at the top of the agenda, making it visible, and making his dedication to getting rid of that statute very clear. And this is at least the third or fourth time in a major venue since his inauguration that the president has reiterated the need to repeal, as he quite properly puts it, the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, because the statute doesn't defend anybody's marriage. All that it does is to undermine the marriages of committed couples who are denied equal treatment under federal law.
Just in the last minute then, the don't ask, don't tell. What's the future of that? And here in California, we, of course, have Proposition 8, which many people want to overturn, and we're shocked that it passed in the first place.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think that where the don't ask, don't tell policy is concerned, this is an area where the administration has some more work to do. And I say that quite candidly. I think that while we do need to repeal this statute through Congress, there are steps that we can take in the interim. We can change the way that the policy is enforced so as to reduce the number of discharges and to stop enforcing it in a punitive fashion. Defense Secretary Gates, suggested that possibility a few months ago, but there hasn't been action on that yet. And we can also start getting some of the messaging out of the executive a little bit more clear. The president has been clear for the entire time about his considering it a priority to get rid of this statute. But the fact is that his national security advisor, Jim Jones, Secretary Gates at times, have been a little bit equivocal in the way that they talk about the issue when it comes up, and that's not helpful. So I think the administration can be taxed with being a little bit more clear in the messaging that their high-level administration officials are putting out on this, and taking some concrete steps to mitigate the harm while we are working to get this statute repealed. I think that we have the votes in Congress to do it, so long as senators and members of the House are clear that this is not just an administration priority, but something that the Pentagon and the senior military leadership are on board with. And I think that we have a bit more work to do in making that sufficiently clear.
Well, Tomas Wolf, I'm afraid we don't have time to get into the California situation, so we'll take a rain check on that, if you like. I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Tobias Barrington Wolf, who writes and teaches in civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. He served as counsel on Strauss versus Horton, which challenged a ballot initiative seeking to deprive same-sex couples of the right to marry, and Cook v. Gates, challenging the constitutionality of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He was also legal advisor, policy chair to Senator Barack Obama's campaign for America in 2008. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Janie Coolidge, assistant producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.